From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
You can tell a lot about a person by what they do when they're late. This is a theory that I've literally just made up right now, but I am inspired by Chip Gaines. Chip Gaines of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Chip Gaines of Fixer Upper, Chip Gaines of Magnolia. You know Chip Gaines. Anyway, I was supposed to talk to Chip Gaines. He was like a few minutes late, like literally just a few minutes late. And when he arrived, this is how he started.
Jason, Chip Gaines, listen, I'm a big believer in time and how we've only got so many hours in a day. And I think about this a lot, about back when I was broke and couldn't pay the bills, I had a certain amount of hours in the day, and slightly further up the food chain where we currently are now, I still have those same exact amount of hours. And you look at Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, I mean, you know, obviously whomever, they have those same exact hours in the day. So I apologize that I've stolen a few of your minutes. So of course, tack whatever we had committed to previously onto the end of this. We don't want you to feel shortchanged or circuited for my lack of punctuality here.
And that, I have to tell you, as you will understand and experience in just a moment, is really perfect Chip Gaines. For those counting, that was a 35-second apology that spanned philosophy and personal connection and understanding. I mean, that's what this guy is. That's why I say you can learn a lot from somebody by how they are late. So, how did I get on Chip Gaines's busy calendar? Well, Chip just came out with a memoir called No Pain, No Gains, where he talks about the challenges of building a business and how incredibly important his network is. In many ways, his book is like a guide to great networking, but not in the transactional sense, in the strong ties, strong relationships, get through anything together sense, which I just felt was a really valuable thing for entrepreneurs to hear and think about. And this, as you'll hear, is really at the core of Chip and Joanna's worldview. They are not just building something for themselves, they are building it for their community, for their network. I mean, here's how Chip says it.
It's just like, listen, man, we want to do the most good. We want to have a network that means something to not only us and our family, but to this community. And then hopefully this community impacts the world at large.
And what are they building? Well, here is the very brief story, if you don't already know it. So Chip and Joanna were running a struggling real estate company in Waco, Texas. And then they got a show on HGTV called Fixer Upper, which transformed their lives. And you might even say transformed real estate television as well, because it was just such a gigantic success. Then they used that fame and newfound clout to build, well, build things right in their hometown where they never left and where they feel a mission to support. They've built a shopping district, a regional real estate company, vacation rentals, product partnerships with Target and others, and so much more. And after walking away from their TV show because they had gotten burned out, I mean, they did that, and we talk about that. There was no amount of money that could get them to go back to the show. They are now doing things their own way. They're launching an entire TV network called Magnolia. And in my conversation with Chip, I really got to understand how he thinks through all of this. And I have to say, it is a valuable way to look at the world. It is grounded. And we also talk about how he got there, how he's grateful that he reached the level of success that he did when he was older, instead of when he was young and thought that he deserved it. Because by then, you know, he'd experienced enough loss to feel humble and to know what matters and what doesn't. Anyway, as you can tell, I just really enjoyed talking with the guy, and I am excited to bring you the full conversation. We spoke originally for an article in the March 2021 issue of Entrepreneur, and you can read that there. It's an edited version of what you're about to hear now, but I wanted you to hear just everything. Everything, including more and more talk about the amount of time that we had together. Because Chip, he might have been a few minutes late, and Chip, I do not fault you for it, but boy, he gave me much more in return. All right, all coming up after the break. If you listen to Problem Solvers, then you know that running a business means constantly solving problems. Endless to-do lists, employees to take care of, and your ever-present bottom line. So here's something that'll solve one of those problems right away. It is called Gusto. Gusto built an easier and more affordable way to manage payroll, benefits, and more. They help over 100,000 businesses with tasks like automated payroll tax filing, simple direct deposits, free health insurance administration, 401ks, onboarding tools, you name it, Gusto made it easy. And they really care about the small business owners they work with. Their support team is attentive and helpful. And since money can be tight right now, you will even get 3 free months once you run your first payroll. Just go to gusto.com/problem solvers and start setting up your business today. You will see what I mean when I say that it's easy. Again, that's 3 months of free payroll at Gusto. That is G-U-S-T-O, gusto.com/problem solvers. All right, we're back. So like I said, this is an episode of me talking with Chip Gaines of Magnolia slash Fixer Upper fame. And we're talking about networking and finding just a sense of groundedness and so much more. Also, you will learn the value of telling people that you don't care about their money, which is a hard thing to do. But boy, it turns out to be powerful. Anyway, I started the interview by quoting Chip to Chip because there was something from his memoir that I really wanted him to expand upon. So here's that. So from the book, you know, you're talking about building a network. You says it requires hope and lots of very hard work. Not necessarily the kind of work that makes your back ache or your hands throb, but equally hard, fulfilling work. So I want to ask you to dive into that more because I think that people understand that a network is an important resource, but they don't always understand how to build it and what's required to maintain it. And I like you framing it in terms of something that also requires work. Tell me more about what you mean by that.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Great question. Bottom line, I would say that I've struggled, and I would almost explain it this way, that it's been my life's most complicated struggle. I hope I don't get emotional or too philosophical here, but my life's most complicated struggle has been summarized by the thought that if you don't sweat, if you don't physically feel exhausted by your work, because I am a tradesman by God's divine appointment. I mean, I came out of the womb in a little bit of a way, a blue collar, hardworking guy. My dad's a hard worker. I say this to my kids all the time. Kids, you have no choice genetically. You know, your grandparents were hard workers. Your mom and daddy are hard worker. You can flail around. You can make some mistakes along the way. Nobody's perfect. I'm not saying you're never going to have a season of laziness, but make no mistake, you're going to end up in a category of I work hard. That's what you do. And so all that to say, pardon me, when I worked hard, I toiled literally in the dirt. And I had a very hard time producing enough income, obviously, to support my family. All these things happened. I've never filed for bankruptcy technically, but we've been on the absolute verge of that multiple times in our careers. My point I'm trying to make is when I evolved, when this television show occurred, and then other opportunities that exceeded my wildest expectations by 1,000, easily by 1,000, I woke up one day in the office pouring my heart and soul into thoughts and ideas and concepts, but then I would go home and I would have a real emotional, not a power struggle, what's the word? It's almost like an identity crisis. I had an identity crisis because I was like, why are my hands not blistered? Why am I not bleeding? Why is my back not aching? I didn't even work today. I didn't do anything. So literally, you know, 9 o'clock at night, I'm out then doing some random chore with farm animals on a 40-acre tract of land. And I found myself in this real odd place. I was getting less and less sleep, which a lot of entrepreneurs can relate to. I'm not griping about that reality. I just found myself overwhelmed by the reality that I've got a full-time job that doesn't require a whole lot of quote unquote sweat equity. And then I don't feel like I've done anything because in my universe, if you haven't sweat and your back's not aching, you haven't actually worked yet. So then I'd have to come back and get a little few hours of work in. So then I'd finally hit the sack going, oh, now that's a hard day's work. Oh, I can feel it in my back. I sweat, I whatever. And so to clarify what I mean by all of this is that same feeling of accomplishment that you have when your back is aching and you've poured your heart and soul into whatever. You know, not everybody's a blue collar worker like myself. Obviously, some people, rightfully so, and thankfully. I mean, I did it the hardest way imaginable. So I don't encourage anybody to do it the way I did it, trust me, stay the course, you know, get a good education, put some savings in the bank, go do a quote unquote business plan, do all the smart, wise, intelligent things. I'm not belittling any of those practical things. But the point I'm making is that when I found success, which was obviously later in my career, into my 30s, early 40s, I'm 46 now, if that means anything to anybody, it's just like, whatever. I feel like I'm in the prime of my life, and I probably am. But in practical, theoretical sense, I felt like I was a little bit of a late bloomer. I thought I would have felt this type of success in my mid-20s, early 30s, and it was elusive at those times in my life. My point is that the same amount of equity that I built in the fact that I could outwork the next guy or the next girl, you know, I felt like there was this innate ability to outwork the competition, quote unquote. I felt equally confident about my network. In that sense, that I wouldn't be where I am and I wouldn't be who I am had it not been for the countless hours that I spent, not networking in the traditional sense of the word, like at a country club. I'm kind of critical, and I don't mean to pick on any specific group because that's not really my thing. I'm not throwing rocks across a fence by any stretch of the imagination, but I am trying to clarify. I'm not talking about networking in the sense that I do this for you and you do this for me, this scratch your back and you scratch mine kind of way. I'm talking about I needed something and you were there for me, or you needed something and I was there for you, or I spent countless hours consulting you about things that I happen to be an expert in, or God knows thousands of examples, you spent countless hours consulting me on things that you were an expert in. And when I got to where I was going, which I would say was probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, and things started turning where I would argue the wind felt to Joe and I both, and I don't mean this in a negative sense. I mean, I just mean this was just our plot. The wind was in our faces. From the time I graduated from Baylor University, which would have been 1998, December 98 was my graduation date. So let's just call it 99. The world was my oyster and I could have done anything in the world. And people were voting me. I wasn't in student council and student government, that kind of thing. But I mean, just in the fraternity sense of the word, oh, you're going to be the president of the United States. You're going to be the most likely to succeed. Yeah, we all made better grades than you, but everybody knows you're going to go out and do all this stuff. Well, 10 years later, you know, so 98, 99 to what would that be? Let's call it roughly 2000. That'd get me to 2009. I woke up in 2009, and this is ironic. I haven't ever thought about it this practically, but right in the middle of a real estate crisis that, I mean, had my name written all over it. Every mistake in the book had been made by Chip Carter Gaines Incorporated. I had rolled the dice so many times and literally all in. And in 2008, so I mean, all the textbook worst case scenarios literally came completely crashing down on us in 2009, almost more specifically 2010 for us personally. Waco was a little isolated or insulated. The tsunami hadn't actually hit till late 2009 and early 2010. So that's where we really started feeling the heat. And I mean, we had all of our chips in that basket. But my point, back to this point that I appreciate you kind of wrestling with me about, is that that network that I had poured my life into became so crucial to us in those moments. I mean, we had people loaning us money. I mean, it felt a little bit like it wasn't quite philanthropic like it is in the amazing movie that we all watch annually, which is It's a Wonderful Life. But, you know, you just see this basket of money being poured on the table and him bawling his eyes out. And they're like, you're the richest man in town, despite the fact he was about to go to jail and he owed some guy some money and all these things. I mean, that was kind of a very similar circumstance to Joe and I's reality. And when we woke up and we realized how important that network was, this is why this book became so impossible not to write here recently, was that I literally had the opportunity, of course, you'll probably get to this a little later in the interview, so don't let me jump ahead, but the opportunity that David Zaslav, a guy calls us out of absolutely the blue and says, listen, what if we were to consider giving you a network and you branding it in this way, and then it wouldn't be required to you physically be on television? Is that something you're interested in? And Joe and I appreciated the offer simply because he was one of the only people in the universe as we were being pawed at from a million different directions. Most people were like, we want you to do a show and we're going to pay you an exorbitant amount of money to do that show. Yes or no? And then we would tell the people, bless their hearts, they didn't mean anything by it, but it's not about the money. And they would laugh and they'd say, yeah, they all say that. And then they'd send us a contract 2 weeks later with an even bigger amount of money than the previous enormous amount of money. And we're like, I mean, when we say it's not about the money, we mean it. David understood that what for us, it's about the business. It's about the opportunity to build a network, which obviously in its nuts and bolts is a business no different than a lawn company, which I ran in my 20s. I mean, it's just a different version of the entrepreneurial experience. And when I, when
although what you just said there is funny, what you just said there is funny because it turns out that not caring about the money turns out to be a pretty good negotiating tactic to get more money.
That is a fact. I mean, don't let the cat out of the bag. I mean, this would be a funny angle to be like, hey, and it's not a bad negotiating tool. So, hey, anybody that wants to try it. Now, the downside is once you've played that bluff, you know, it's hard to back out once the circumstances get a little complicated. But I will say to your point, Jason, I've never found a more powerful negotiating tool than to look somebody in the eyeballs and say it's not about the money and for their knees to get weak and think he might actually mean it. Now, in fairness, the money pays the bills and it's what keeps the world turning and all these things. So, I mean, you know, money definitely plays a part in it. But David Zasloff specifically understood that what was important to us was the idea that we had the opportunity to build a business together with him. And when I thought about this book, I was like, what are the chances, the Chip Gaines, all the expectations that I had for myself, that my parents had for me, that my friends had for me, all of the things that were really weighty as a 20-year-old, because I was like, you know, it's almost like being the New York Yankees number one draft pick. I mean, you were expected to go out and do incredible things. And I had kind of that level of expectations from a business and a just a life perspective. I've kind of been a sort of a golden child even since I was a kid. And in that sense, there was 10 or 15 years to where everybody was like, where is this guy? Has he done anything? You know, I'm over here making this kind of money. And what's he doing? He's buying houses in Waco and flipping them. I mean, what good could that be? Why isn't this guy working for Ernst Young or you know, consulting with Anderson Consulting or some amazing opportunity, maybe even bigger than those two I've mentioned, you know, off the cuff. But all this to say, it was just like that network piece became a real oxymoron and a little bit of an anomaly that I really wanted to wrestle with. To say we're building a network, but had I not built my network, and to your point earlier in the question, was just like poured that sweat equity into these ideas and these relationships and these opportunities, not for what I could get out of them, but for what they meant, only in the circumstance, only in the moment, I wouldn't have had this opportunity to build an actual network, which is obviously a pretty exclusive, pretty elusive group. When you start identifying who in the world owns a network, there's a handful of people that for us to be included in is mind-boggling.
Right. Something you, in that amazing 20-part answer, something that you said towards the beginning, I want to have you expand upon. So when I asked you about to define that hard work and building a network, you gave me this interesting psychological thing that you've gone through, which is that you used to equate work with physical labor and with the strains of physical labor, which meant that probably for a while, I'm going to guess, something like building a network of people, didn't seem like work or didn't seem like it was valuable because it didn't make your back hurt. So I want to put to you something that Malcolm Gladwell told me a long time ago when I interviewed him for the magazine, which was that he said, I've used this line a million times since he said it to me, self-perceptions are powerfully limiting. If you understand yourself to be one thing, then you will miss out on all these other opportunities. And I feel like what you just described there was an interesting crossroads. And I'm just wondering if you can expand upon how you got over it, which is that if you had defined hard work in one way, which you did for a while, hard work only means that your back hurts at the end of the day. Well, you would have missed out on all these other things that are hard work and are the building blocks of something greater, but that don't actually make your back hurt at the end of the day.
Sure.
How did you expand your definition of hard work?
That's beautiful. And I would honestly say, Jason, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that's why I was so heavy-handed about it at the beginning. It's been my life's most complicated work. I still have not resolved that puzzle. I feel unfulfilled in a deep, really artificial. It's not even valid. It's not accurate, but I feel unfulfilled when I'm not physically doing what I would refer to as backbreaking manual labor. And I still struggle with it today, right this second, all the circumstances and the success. And I will say we've got a weird, and I think a lot of driven type A personalities have this weird fear of failure mixed into the equation. I keep thinking that the world is going to find us out any minute. And as soon as they find us out, then it's over. And so I work to build up walls and ammunition to defend ourselves against that evolution of being found out as a phony or something like that. But the point you just made and the question, you know, the quote you used by Malcolm is so powerful because that's what I'm excellent at. I don't have a self-fulfilling prophecy that I have to do this and that, but I will say with the giant caveat that except for that work piece of the puzzle. So to your question about like, how did I solve it? To be really frank, I definitely feel like I've got my hands around it and I'm getting closer to solving that question in my own life. But I will say building a network always felt like valuable work. So I didn't discredit it in that way that I described earlier about it. Well, it's not worth it because I have this like inherent love for people. So when I think about building a network, a lot of times it was just taking late night phone calls, kind of rolling your eyes going, oh man, this one's not going to be short. You know, I can tell you this is going to take me an hour or two. I had a friend, we wrote about it in our previous book, and I don't use it to kind of drum up some pat on the back, but it just was a story that I liked to articulate. It was 11 o'clock at night and I was kind of burning the candle at both ends, back to my point about not sleeping real great. And this guy calls me about 11 and he had this gentleman that was on his front porch that needed a helping hand. And this poor guy knew if I call Chip, there's a chance that he might be dumb enough to come and do this. And so at 11 o'clock at night, driving rain, I go and pick this guy up off of this friend of mine's porch. And the reason this guy called me is we had some opportunities with some vacant houses that this guy maybe could find a place to at least shelter for the night. And we went through this whole experience together. But what drove me to that position was less about backbreaking work in the specific sense and more about my overall love for people. And so I cared about that guy, which was my neighbor and friend, but I also cared about that guy that ended up in such a bad spot that he was on this guy's front porch and driving a thunderstorm in Waco, Texas. And so I had the opportunity to resolve that issue for both of those parties and did it. But I guess just to clarify, I haven't gotten great at the backbreaking part of the equation, not being technically a part of my daily job. And how do I feel fulfilled at the end of the day? I'm still wrestling with those pros and cons. But the network piece of it, I think people appreciated my sincerity because they knew back 10 years ago, there was nothing in it for either party. I didn't feel like there was something in it only for them. And I felt like a pawn in the equation. And I certainly assumed they didn't feel like I was doing it for any other reason than, bro, I love you and I care about you and I want to help you if you're in a position to need that help. And so as I work in this network thing, it's kind of a little bit complicated because really what I mean is a network of support, a network of camaraderie to where it's like when you think about locking elbows with somebody and it's kind of like Rover, Red Rover, send the guy over and you're not going to break through my line. I'd rather die than let that be the case that I in fact broke the line and caused us all to suffer for that. That network is what allowed Joe and I to get from point A to B was a lot of hard work and a lot of learning and all the stuff that everybody goes through in their 20s and their 30s. But from 30s to 40s and 40 till hopefully I'm looking off 4 years from now into my 50s, you know, I want that to be less about luck and self-exploration and all this stuff and more about, no, I've hooked arms with the right people and my network, I'd put up against anybody's network, no different than if you're a Dallas Cowboy fan, you'd say I'd put my Cowboys. Now, obviously it's been a rough decade for the Cowboys. So terrible right. example, but you know, if they lock arms and say, hey, we'd put them up against anybody. Well, sure. I mean, who wants to go into the season thinking that they're going to lose? You right. know?
In theory, nobody breaks through that. When you were talking a minute ago about feeling, I don't know that you used the words, but what you were talking about was an imposter syndrome that you still feel like you carry in some way, right? Like that at some sure. point people are going to be like, what are you guys get out of here. That so your book, you describe a similar imposter syndrome as a kid, right? And then the story as you tell it is that you sort of kept misrepresenting yourself really up until you met Joanna and then she forced you out of it. And I want to run a theory by you. And sure. the theory, which just popped into my head as I heard you talk, was that back then, that was not a healthy thing to do. But now, I wonder if the imposter syndrome that you feel actually is pretty useful, because it's an engine that forces you to continue to build and innovate what you're doing so that you stay ahead of whatever these imaginary people are who are going to come tell you that you don't belong. You think that's true?
Absolutely, 100%. And I think it's twofold, to be really specific. And I love great dialogue like this. You're doing a great job, Jason. I'm not saying that as a smoke blower. I mean that in a real sincere way, because it's making my brain work in a million different directions. But twofold, that chameleon-like scenario, which to your point, I look back on and I have a lot of regrets about it. I don't feel great about it. I was trying to be all things for all people. All the things that you hear and you articulate, generally speaking, as negatives, I was kind of that person. I didn't want to disappoint anybody. So in that effort to not disappoint anybody, you found yourself in complicated conflicts to where lies were about the only real option to get yourself out of these conflicts that you had created. But fast forward, and I'm a man of faith, we're a family of faith. And so I only say that to say, I feel like in God's grace, the power of that is that I have inadvertently developed empathy for lots and lots of categories. I would argue I feel for lots and lots of people, even when I can't say literally that I've walked a mile in their shoes. Now, I've done a lot of stuff. I've made a lot of trips around the earth. And I don't mean that figuratively from a travel standpoint. We kind of hate to travel. We travel when we have to. And I have kind of been around the world, but I don't love that element. But I mean, you talk about a dude that's done a bunch of junk. I've negotiated with the lawn guy to figure out how to get a real remedial service accomplished at a lower rate in that kind of way. And I've negotiated with titans of industries that could squish me like a bug and not even think twice and go back to the tennis court and not even remember my name in that sense. And so when you think about a guy who's done a lot of things, I've been around the block, I've done a lot of things, but my point in saying that is less about the braggy sounding elements of it and more about the, man, I have the ability to reach across a desk and try to relate to somebody, even when they were brought up on a different side of the planet under different circumstances than me, times a thousand on a different side. And so somehow—
And that's because you feel like you tried on so many different identities, or
100%.
Because you— Yes.
And so I would say I landed confidently in this place. Like, look, back to my point about don't do it the way I did it. You know, I tell my kids this. I tell anybody who listened, I've done it the hardest way possible. Don't do it this way. But I will say that when God kind of revealed to me the negative moral sense of the word that I was a liar in some cases, and I hate to admit it, that black and white, but there's really no other way to justify it. They were not accurate statements that I would make consistently to work in and out of situations. Once I clarified that piece of the puzzle, the other stuff that did come through the gauntlet were actually huge benefits to me. I was able to see things from lots and lots of different perspectives. And I think that when I'm in the middle of a complicated discussion or negotiation, we'll say it in that way, I think people somehow engage with that idea that at least he hears me, at least he sees me, at least he understands our perspective. Even if we agree to disagree, we can kind of work in some, like we hope the country can do, obviously in this particular complicated mess that we're in, but is this idea of reaching across and shaking hands in the middle and saying, this is best for both parties. I had to concede a little, you had to concede to a little, and we met in the middle. But sorry, there was another point that was my secondary thought to your question. So that part of it, can you repeat the question if you remember it? Because there was a secondary piece that I wanted to scratch real quick if you remembered it, Jason.
Well, I mean, I had asked you if you felt like the imposter syndrome had been useful. And it's interesting because I had asked you, really thinking about it, is whether it was useful in business now. But you then went on to talk about how it was actually quite valuable having gone through multiple identities as you were younger, and that giving you an understanding of what other people were doing and thinking. But that was the question.
You did great. Forgot the
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Well, look, we're coming up on time. So let me just ask you one other thing.
Back to me. I may be able to pop it back up a little bit later. Keep going.
Yeah, sure. So, well, I wanted to follow up on one other thing that you had said, which actually was something or similar in subject to something that John and I were talking about before you popped on. You know, you were talking about, you said you're 40, so you said you're 46.
Yes, sir.
I'm 40. And you said, you know, you felt like you were a late bloomer. You found maybe a version of whatever you had imagined as success for yourself, although I'm sure that it is quite different from whatever you originally imagined to be later. And I was telling John, and I'm just going to tell you this same anecdote and see what you think about it. I was telling John that every time I hear about that, I'm reminded of this thing that I heard John Hodgman, the comedian, say. I just turned on the radio one day and I heard him talking. And he was talking about how he aspired to be famous when he was young. Mm. And it didn't happen. And eventually he moved on to other dreams. And then he became famous later. and how disorienting that was, but also how he ultimately realized that it was so valuable because he had come to an understanding of who he was, and fame had not been the primary thing that he was seeking. So when it came to him, he felt like he knew what to do with it more. Yeah. And I put this to you, not really about fame, because, you know, very few people can relate to that, but to a kind of large success where you get to call shots. And you find that, or you could find that earlier, you could find that later. You know, you're describing it to me as if you found it later. And I'm wondering if you think that that ultimately was valuable, or if you wish you found it earlier.
Oh, it's so funny. So I hope don't sound like I'm just echoing every thought you have. And yeah, what you said, you know, why don't you just write this article without me? We seem like we're
perfect. I ask questions just for validation. So I appreciate it.
Exactly. Well, you're a smart guy, Jason. So all that to say, absolutely. I say this, Joe, frequently. I say this to our inner circle of friends that I care about and care about their lives and their marriages and their kids, and really want them to be successful human beings, you know, for lack of a better term. Because I mean, for me, that's really what I mean by success, is that you're a successful human being, and I hope you give it your all in your day job. But you know, if it costs you everything to go be on some mountain all by yourself, I can assure you it's not worth it. But that being said, I would have been a terrible, terrible human, Jason, if this had happened. And it could have. I mean, as I look at all the circumstances and the variables, somebody could have called me when I was 27, 31, 35. I mean, there was 100 opportunities for some random person to find some random blog about us doing houses in Waco, Texas. I mean, this could have happened a million times over. And instead, it happened exactly when it happened. And I'm telling you, humility had entered the equation. I'm still extremely confident. I would argue people that wrestle with me on a daily basis, John might be able to echo this. Of course, you're welcome to echo this thought, John. But you know, I almost am so confident that people misinterpret that confidence for arrogance. And I don't disagree with the thought that I could be, you know. But my point is, I had been through the ringer and basically lost in a lot of ways. To your point with that comedian, it wasn't like I kind of hadn't accomplished what I had set out to do. I had not accomplished what I had set out to accomplish. Period. End of story. At that second, if I put a pass or a fail grade on that report card, I failed at that up till that point in my career. And to your point, no drastic things had happened. It wasn't the end of the world. There's always the do-overs and that kind of thing. But I mean, as far as the way I evaluate life is that you win and you lose. You get where you a goal that you had set and you accomplished it, you did it. If you didn't, you didn't. I mean, it's no reason worrying about all the excuses as to why you didn't, you just didn't. And I mean, I hadn't, beyond a shadow of a doubt. And I am so thankful, to be frank, that I hadn't, because that piece of the humility puzzle that now exists in my ecosystem and now exists in my person is so valuable to me. And maybe that's a really interesting thought, is back to my chameleon days. I had a lot of pieces of the puzzle in place, but humility was not one of them. And I can assure you that it wasn't one of them. But to add that to that place, now I have this empathy of humility that also accompanies all these other characteristics. And I would say that I wouldn't change it for the world. I wouldn't have gone back and gotten this 10 years earlier, even if I could have been twice as far than I am now in this journey. Because now it's just like, hey, man, wherever we're heading, two, it's not about the money. And again, I keep saying that, I don't mean to be a broken record, but my goal isn't to be a billion or 100 million or 20 this. I mean, it's just like, listen, man, we want to do the most good. We want to have a network that means something to not only us and our family, but to this community. And then hopefully this community impacts the world at large. And when you start piecing those things together and you see that spider web and you see how vast it can be and how far reaching it can be, things get pretty exciting pretty quickly, because you know, in real life, you can make an impact on the world. And most people have to say that in a pretty aw shucks, you know, I did something for my dog or something this morning. Well, that's not nothing. But the way we operate here in Waco, and John kind of alluded to it earlier about it being the epicenter, is that we've got a poverty rate in Waco, Texas, which is out of whack in relationship to statistically the way it should be as it fits in a larger global piece. And we're not going to, that won't be the case. We're not going to die. And on our watch, that reality that Waco, Texas has a disproportionate poverty rate to the rest of the country isn't going to stand on our watch. And I don't care what that means as it relates to me being on the Fortune Forbes 100 list or something net worth wise. I just know you can take that to the bank. And that's just one example of a dozen examples that are so important to Joe and I that when this is all said and done and the music stops, we're going to be on our rocking chairs here at this 40-acre farm, most likely. You know, anything's possible and we'll see how it all shakes out. But if this is really our forever place, which I would bet it probably is, we're going to be on that rocking chair saying, we made an actual impact in our community. Because do you remember when we took on this challenge of tackling our local poverty rate? You remember what that number was? Yeah, we remember. And do you remember what it is now? Yeah, it's below the national average. And you know, even what that means practically, who gives a crap? Who cares? But I can tell you why it matters to us, because it matters to us about the people that are actually represented in those statistics. So sorry, I hope I didn't chase that one too far off the track.
No, that was great. And look, you okay. So we're over time. You opened up by
keep
being
going.
Very
keep going. Come on, you got more in you.
Okay, this seems like a pretty rational place to pause because right at the very beginning of this episode, I shared that Chip was so generous when he was running just a few minutes late. And I wanted to watch the clock and cut off when, you know, we promised him. He said we would tack on the extra time. I did. And I watched the clock. I know the guy's busy. And so here I am trying to wrap it up for him. And he's like, no, we got to keep going. I'm telling you, this guy, I love this guy. All right, so we're going to take a short break for one more sponsor. And then when we come back, it's bonus time with Chip Gaines. It's all the extra time and the more conversation that he was so generous to offer. Just the other day, I opened this app that I use all the time and it had no idea who I was. It wanted me to enter my username and password. Come on, I don't remember my username and password. Just let me in. Why don't you remember me? You know what this is? It is an identity problem. And this is the type of experience that Ping Identity makes awesome. So what is Ping Identity? It is the leader in global enterprise identity security, and it helps the world's largest organizations deliver secure, extraordinary digital experiences to their employees and customers. Because look, security is very important, but it shouldn't also have to be bothersome. If your app forgets your most loyal customers, you've got a problem. If your internal systems can't enable your employees to securely access anything they need without constantly entering and changing passwords, you've got a problem. And so Ping Identity solves those problems. It makes your business secure and agile, so customers can access what they want when they want it, and your employees can be productivity rock stars no matter where they are. Ping Identity is the champion of enterprise identity security. You want to learn more? Just go to pingidentity.com. Again, that is ping, P-I-N-G, pingidentity.com. All right, we're back. And so it is now going into bonus time with Chip Gaines. I'm just going to jump right into it.
I'll take the time if you've got it. So first of all, that was a really interesting answer because I felt like it looped back around to something that we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, which was, you know, the power. I mean, I joked, but it was also true, right? The power that you have to not care about the money, which turns out to be a pretty good negotiation tactic, right? But like, why don't you care about it? And I feel like part of the answer is just who you people are, but also part of the answer was what you just said there, was that by the time that you got to the point where people are throwing lots of money at you, you had established an identity for yourself and an understanding of what you wanted to do that meant that these other things weren't as much of a temptation. Whereas maybe in your 20s, where you didn't have the same compass that you do now, people throwing lots of money at you might have felt quite different.
Totally.
You think
I'm
right? I'm
telling you, beyond a shadow of a doubt, not only would it have felt different, but it would have ruined me personally. And I don't have any doubts about that. It's not like one of these hypotheticals. It's like it would have ruined me as a human being. And so I'm so thankful that it didn't happen when I sure wished it would have. I was certainly hoping that it was going to play out a little bit differently. But then in addition to your point, and maybe this will be something your readers will appreciate and think about, but in almost the most sincere place I can say it, and I only use this exact number because it's kind of what we were making 10, 15 years ago when this ball started rolling in this direction. So, but I was making all the money I needed to make when I was making $100,000 a year. When I hit a six-figure number, in my mind, that clicked a release lever that was like, you've done something. You kind of made it in the figurative sense. Now, obviously, I had loftier expectations than just that bare minimum, but I would say it alleviated some pressure. So the reason that people are screwed now when they negotiate with Chip and Joanna Gaines from Waco, Texas, and the sole negotiation point from their perspective is money, is that I had enough money when I was making $100,000 a year. So that became no longer a valid motivator for me to consider whatever Jason had to offer under the circumstances. If the deal makes sense and we're excited about it and we want to do it, great. Let's negotiate the money. You know, what's the money look like? Well, here's some numbers. Oh, that's a lot more than 100,000. So sure, let's consider it, you know? So I just, I think that people put too much value, even when you think about negotiating your salary at the office. I mean, if the job is not fulfilling, if it doesn't make you wake up early in the morning and stay up late at night, the money isn't going to solve that part of the riddle. It's just not. So you can always concede. And I'm not even belittling this. I get sometimes there's seasons of your life going, you know what? I got to do it for the money because I've got kids to feed and I've got an education fund that I'm trying to fund. And I've got dreams that when I retire, I'm going to go off and do all these great, man, great. I'd never throw a rock at somebody who had a real great plan as it related to that. But I would just challenge that thought with the idea that, does it fulfill you in a real intimate way in your heart? Do you feel like you're doing the work that only you can do, that you were born? I mean, back to my faith, it's like, I believe that we were all born specifically the second we were born to go off and accomplish what we were meant to accomplish. And I just think, you know, there's a movie and you're great at quoting the names and the people specifically, and I'm opposite, I'm the worst, but there was a movie where he's like, the devil's greatest trick was to convince the world,
that it didn't exist. Sure. Yeah.
Kevin
Spacey, and it was
Unusual Suspects.
Usual Suspects, yes.
When you said Kevin Spacey, I was way out in left field, but yeah. When you said it, I was like, it was Usual Suspects. And I feel that same argument, a little caveat, which is, instead of that he didn't exist, I think the devil's greatest trick that he's played on humanity is to believe that to be successful, you have to do all these things that require go get a good job or get a good education, get a good job, make sure that good job has a good retirement thing. And it's like we get hooked up into this momentum like salmon in a stream. And before we even know why we're going in that direction, we've already got $100,000 worth of student loans. And once you get that piece of the puzzle into place, back to my devil example, don't overquote me here because I don't want to sound like a TV evangelist or something this, because I don't mean it in this way. I just mean, once you get that piece set, then the person then has to go, well, I got to get the good job because I got to pay for all the student loan that I've just acquired. And all these things just start moving in that direction. And then you're 50 and you pop out and you're like, why did I get in this stream again? What was I doing here? And so I just hope that we all take a minute to really evaluate what is it that we're here on planet Earth to accomplish. And if we're accomplishing that in those 9-to-5 jobs, back to my point about not throwing rocks, great. Then you're in your perfect place. You're doing the perfect thing for you and your family and your life. But if you're there because somebody told you that was the thing to do and you never questioned that source of information and you jumped in there and now you're like, oh crap, what have I done with myself? Don't stay there a minute longer than you've got to. You know, there's a whole world out there that exists that are unencumbered by all those strings and all those requirements that when you get out there, and a few people do, and most of those people you've then had the honor to report about, even that comedian, I love that thought. And then I wasn't famous. And so I had to go realize what that looked like. And yet here he is famous. It's like, bro, you were destined to be that. It just, you had to get some of the pieces of the puzzle in the appropriate places before it was time, you know, sure. In some way.
And something that people struggle with, I mean, I think that the advice that you're giving here is spot on. Of course, the thing that people struggle with and why they don't walk away is because it's, well, one, it's hard to walk away from what feels like a sure thing.
Sure.
It's hard to trade what might fulfill some of your requirements for something that might fulfill more of your requirements, but you don't know. And this is where this is the early entrepreneur's dilemma of what to do. So I'm curious how you thought through it and what lessons you've drawn from this experience, because there's this anecdote in your book that you include really in passing, which is you're describing feeling boxed in by the show. And how people referring to your house and your construction site as on set started to really wear on you. And so this is an interesting insight, because you had a hit show. You probably could have run that thing forever and ever. And so something is wearing away it, but you could imagine a lot of other people making a different decision than you did, which is, okay, I'm going to have to just figure out how to swallow this or process it, because there's too many good things happening here and I'm not going to walk away from this. Now, but you did, and obviously a privileged situation to be able to do so, but Everyone's got some version of it, some job that fulfills quite a lot of what they're looking for, but not everything. And then they start to feel emptier and emptier because they need something more. So take me into the thought process of actually, you know, not the entertainment side of it, but the human side of it, of making a decision to leave something that was very good, but not exactly right anymore.
Sure. I will say one gift that I've been given, and you know, I use some negative examples of the chameleon and some of the other circumstances, sort of a late bloomer in some ways. I mean, all these things I would argue kind of fell in a negative bucket. A positive bucket that I inherited just genetically was just a fearless nature. And I believe that what's on the other side of scary, complicated, impossible opportunities lies what sets winners apart from the alternative options. You know, even when I think about sports specifically, you know, I think about a Derek Jeter, I think about an Alex Rodriguez, I think about a dozen other examples. Nolan Ryan, I'm a big, you know, I'm a Texan, so I had Dallas Cowboys and the Texas Rangers. And when Nolan was pitching into his late 30s, and I can't remember exactly when he retired, but what felt to be early 40s, you know, his legs size of oak trees and dealing 100 mile an hour fastballs even later in his career. My point is, those risks that he was taking on a daily basis paid dividends off that other guys weren't willing to do. And so my point is that I felt like there was a risk involved with taking on the show itself. I mean, early on, and John can attest to this, I mean, we're talking $2,500 is like the amount of money. And I don't want to go into all the details because I don't want to lose the focus, but we're talking $2,500 to go do a thing. And so we weren't talking about a million. We weren't talking about even a $25,000 would have made a real impact in our life at the time. It was like, is this worth $2,500? And you got to scratch your head going, not really. Not if you do the A plus B equals C, it's not worth it, right? I mean, $2,500. And you know, you do the amount of time and energy and all the opportunity costs that exist in some other place. I mean, it was not a lot of money. But that being said, it was the thing that our hearts were drawn to. And to the contrary, when we knew it was over, we knew it was over. So, I mean, it was just, there was no ifs, ands, or buts. God knows. I mean, bless their hearts. I mean, the money that started being offered to us to try to make amends for any complicated thing that we were describing. And then we were just like, guys, hold on. No. We're not bitter about it. We're not mad about it. We're not looking back at this saying all the spilled milk, we want all the milk back. We're just saying, because of the circumstances, our hearts are no longer in this and we got to move to the next place. And back to the, it's not about the money. And then the contracts continue to elevate money. We just kind of got a little comical after three or four efforts going, I don't think they're hearing us, you know? And to your point about that being a hell of a negotiation point, I mean, the things got very exciting very quickly, but Joe and I kept falling into the same place, which is for whatever reason. And to your point, a lot of it did have to do with, you know, a lot of alternative shows to ours were kind of spinning off of our ecosystem that felt a little too close to home. And for Joe and I, we were like, you know, we're not representing a hypothetical thing. We're talking about our actual life. This is what I do for a living. This is what my wife does for a living. And those acreage, I mean, that's not a set. That's our house. That's our home. We live on 40 acres and I got to go feed these animals. This isn't made for television. This is our actual life. And then when you started seeing alternative options that smelled a little similar or felt a little similar. Joe and I were just like, well, we don't want to be muddied with all these other alternatives because we don't want somebody to wake up one day and was like, wait, is that thing real? Because all these other things feel a little interesting or possibly artificial in some ways. And so Joe and I were just real clear that, hey, it's time for us to move to the next chapter of our lives. And I want to be real clear. And I think I mentioned this in the book very clearly. We had some mentors, and I'm not using them in air quotes because, oh, looking back, these people are so dumb. I'm talking about brilliant people that came down and were like, Chip and Joe, make no mistake. If you're ready for all of these things to go away, everything that you've built, all the things that you're excited about, everything you're happy about in the general sense of like success and opportunity and all this, if you want all that to go away, then make the decision you're making. No problem. No harm, no foul. Just do it and go back to your day job. And remember that 100 grand that you keep saying was all the money you ever wanted? Well, get ready because that's the money you're about to start making again because you're an idiot. You're going to go right back to square one. And me and Joe were like, we don't care. We know that this is the next deal. And these folks were very adamant that when we turned off that television set, all this stuff was going to cease to exist. And Jason, as only God can do, as only the universe can do, when we turn that television set off, the opportunities expanded by some literal quantifiable margin of 10, 20, 30, 100. I don't know the net, but I can tell you not only did it all not stop, but it all somehow got bigger and more interesting and even more our hearts stopped feeling like they were drying up on a vine and shriveling up to nothing and we were going to die. To the contrary, we felt alive and we were excited again and we were enthralled by debate and envisioning a life that could look like this hypothetical or this hypothetical as these opportunities started presenting themselves. And I would just say, I think that even these mentors that I'm describing would come back and say, Chip, it's not supposed to work like that. You know, A plus B is supposed to equal C. A plus B is not supposed to equal W. I have no idea how that equation popped in, but that's my point is that Jeff Bezos, you can brag about his billions now and say it was all about that. It wasn't about that when he started it. It just wasn't. And I'm not here to say, I don't know Jeff Bezos from Adam. Maybe it was, and I'm mistaken, but I can assure you, I would bet you a real amount of money that if I were to call Jeff and say, hey, what was it like at the beginning? It's like zero about that. It was not about that at all. I had a different passion and the money just happened to start falling out of the sky as it related to that passion that I had and that decision I made. And that was a real evidence point of when Joe and I decided to cut that television show off, that it was the right decision. It was the right thing for our family. It was the right thing for our life. And then we were rewarded in some weird way by not only was everything drying up on the opposite side of that equation. So maybe that's the point I'm trying to make. Sorry, Jason, it's long-winded, but the thought I've got in my brain that I'm trying to articulate is when those people weigh the pros and cons, your heart and your passion will somehow create the results that you're looking for, even when the formula hasn't caught up with it yet. And I would say if they're sitting in an office and they feel like they're being fulfilled and they're on a journey that's going to lead them to a place that they can't wait to get to, then I would say stay on that path. Stay in that lane. You're where you're supposed to be. But if these people step out of that lane and look up the ladder and see the people who have already accomplished all the things they hope to accomplish someday in their future, and they don't admire their lives and they don't admire their lifestyle and they don't admire the kind of people that they are, maybe in the general sense of the word, then I would say, make no mistake, when you get there, who do you think you're going to be? You're going to be that guy or gal, 3 or 4 or 5 or 100 rungs of the ladder above you. And then you're going to find yourself in the same position that they're probably in, which is, how did I get here? Why did I climb this ladder only to find myself completely unfulfilled, uninspired and all this stuff? Over what? Over the money? And I'm like you. I mean, look, this is very complicated when you're talking about mortgage payments and kids' educations and all the things. So I'm not trying to over belittle it. I'm just saying a lot of times when you go chase your heart and when you chase your passion, I love your comedian's example. When he went and did his thing, finally the money and the fame and the circumstances kind of caught up with him, but he had the cart before the horse, it sounds like, there for a minute. And I certainly feel I can relate to that. I don't throw rocks at a guy like that. I was like, man, did I have the cart before the horse? Man, I was ready for all the fame and all the success and all the circumstances, but I hadn't really paid my dues quite yet. But boy, yeah. When I finally got to that place to where I was firmly grounded in a place to where, A, I knew who I was. I knew who I was as it related to my wife and my kids and all these things. Then all of a sudden, the circumstances started becoming really powerful when you were negotiating terms based on somebody's artificial expectations that you should care about money. And then we were just like, and we don't. And so the circumstances got really exciting in a pretty quick amount of time.
Yeah. It's the power of having the bravery to follow your North Star. Chip, you have been extremely generous with your time, but somebody has to cut you off. And that person is John, who tells me that you have another appointment. So,
All right. Do you have a final thought? Because I want to make sure you get all the way across the finish line.
No. I thought that was a perfect way to land it. So I really, really appreciate your time. It was a total delight. Anyway, then we wrapped it up. So what can we take away from this? So much. But to me, the thing that will always stick with me is Chip's understanding of himself and recognizing that sometimes the really good things have to wait. And sometimes you have to walk away from what seems like the best thing in order to find the truly right thing. Anyway, thanks again to Chip Gaines for all of his time and then some.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.